Good morning. Up right now on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville, it's the Mind and Heart Show. For the next hour, it's thoughts and feelings and the way they affect our lives and the world we live in. The phone number in the studio is 434-284-9470. Now here's your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier.
Good morning, Charlottesville, and welcome to the Mind and Heart Show on WPVC 94.7 FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. I'm your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. Thank you for joining us this morning. We're live here every Saturday morning from 9 to 10, and our show deals with all matters of the mind and heart. Please join us this morning by visiting our Facebook page, Mind and Heart Show. You can send us a tweet at @MindHeartWPVC. Or email us at mindheartwpvc@gmail.com. You can stream the show live at our website, which is WPVC947. I'm sorry, I think I just reversed that. It is 947 WPVC. My apologies. So please join us, share your comments with us, and we would love to hear from you this morning. I am very pleased this morning to introduce my guest for the day. It's Denise Lunsford, who recently was the Commonwealth's attorney for Albemarle County and served 8 years there. Good morning, Denise. Thanks for joining us.
Morning, Jeff. Thanks for having me this morning.
You're welcome. So I wanted to talk some just in general this morning about your career and that position and what's going on in the criminal justice system. So I think we've got a lot of topics to cover. Maybe you could just start by sharing with our listeners what influenced your decision to become an attorney.
You know, I was not one of those kids who always knew what they wanted to be when they grew up. And even when I decided to go to law school, didn't really know what I was going to do after practice. But when I was younger, when I was about 12 or 13, my mother got a job as a court clerk in Tennessee, in the area where I grew up. And I would go to work with her after school. And in those days, the office was open a half day on Saturdays. And to keep me busy, she would send me to the library or send me on errands. Or if I got really annoying, make me file pleadings or read depositions or things of that nature. And she always wanted me to become a lawyer. So, of course, I majored in art when I first went to college and then switched to pre-law. And I think because I kind of enjoyed, without really knowing it, the people aspect of it. That's sort of what I came to like about it. And then when I was in school, I did really well in our moot court competition first year. And that was the first time that I ever really considered or thought that I might be good at litigation. And so from that point, I really wanted to do litigation.
And so did you go right from undergrad to law school, or did you wait a while to make that decision?
I went right from undergrad to law school. I think I wish that I had taken a year off just to kind of clear my head and not have to go straight through. But no, I went straight from undergrad to law.
Yeah.
And then directly into practice.
From there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And criminal law, I mean, you could have gone corporate, you could have gone public service. I mean, there are many ways, but something about criminal law was appealing.
Well, I did go corporate, if you remember.
Well, that's right. I forgot.
I was at Mickey Hamlet for 6.5, almost 7 years after law school, and they're a great firm, and they've always been very good to me then and now. And I did commercial litigation.
Okay, so you were doing civil stuff,
right?
And corporate stuff.
Mickey Hamlet's belief was before you could really litigate a contract or tear a contract apart, you had to know how it went together. So I did some very little, but some corporate transactions. I would totally be committing malpractice if I went back to some of this today, but some employment law and things of that nature. But they also believed very strongly that part of your service as an attorney was to do pro bono work, and we didn't have a public defender's office at the time. So many of the people did court-appointed criminal work, both as a public service and because, in my case, they believed that you know, cross-examining a witness was learning to cross-examine a witness. It didn't matter whether it was a criminal matter or a civil matter. And that's where I really came to like that defense work.
And I guess I have this vision that corporate work and civil work can be pretty dry and pretty boring. I mean, is that a fair characterization, at least from your personal experience?
There were parts of it that were really interesting. I just found that I cared more about the defendants in the criminal cases than I cared about the civil cases. And I think that was a product of who I was and how I grew up and those sorts of things, and not so much one was exciting and one wasn't. I think it's just a matter of personality.
And my recollection is, did you then go to Waynesboro to practice with an established defense attorney there?
No, I had I was living in Waynesboro at the time. I lived in Waynesboro until about 1997, about the time I left Mickey Hamlin. I left Mickey Hamlin and hung out a shingle and
in Charlottesville.
Wow. And took one or two.
It was gutsy
business. Probably. It doesn't seem that way because it was just at the time I didn't have any kids. I was getting a divorce, so you know, it was just me. But it was what I thought would be fun and what I thought would be interesting, and so I hung out a shingle. Took a couple of business clients with me, which kind of went by the wayside after a few years, and I focused exclusively on criminal defense and capital litigation.
Okay. In the interest of full disclosure, I have to tell our listeners that you and I have worked collaboratively over the years. Gosh, I'm guessing 15 years or more.
Or more, yeah.
Yeah, when you were in private practice and then some when you were in the Commonwealth Attorney's Office. So
not always on the same side, though.
No, that's true. That's true. And one of the things that I really enjoyed working with you on either side of a case was just I knew, you know, I had such regard for your integrity and your professionalism, and I always knew even if we were opposed or I was on the other side that I'd get a fair shake. So
thank you.
Wanted to let the listeners know that there's probably a bit of bias in the interview this morning. And then going back a little over 8 years ago, you decided to run for Commonwealth Attorney. That mm-hmm. must have been a big decision.
It was. I had taken a year off. I had taken a sabbatical sometime in late 2005, early 2006. Well, I guess late 2005, I'd made the decision to take a sabbatical, and I was tired. I was kind of worn out, and so I took the sabbatical and didn't really think about what I wanted to do when I went back. Always sort of assuming that I would go back to criminal defense. And then I was out to dinner. Richard and I were out to dinner with some friends one night, and somebody mentioned that the Commonwealth's attorney position in Albemarle was coming up for election that year. It was February. I and another attorney sort of had an interest in it, and the two of us talked about it, and the other attorney said, you know, I'm not going to do it, because I always felt, for a number of reasons, this is just another attorney I know in town, that this person sort of had dibs on it, if you will. They decided not to do it, so talking with Richard, and he thought a campaign would be interesting and fun, and so we decided I'd do it.
And did you have any idea what you were taking on? I mean, I know you were...
Not entirely,
for 8 years, you worked phenomenal hours. Yeah. And whew.
Yeah. I'm still recovering. I knew a little bit, obviously, about what goes on. I think what I didn't realize was the amount of administration, the amount of HR work, the amount of paperwork, the amount of... But I also didn't realize some of the stuff that I found really interesting, which is sort of the movement you can make in the system when you're in that office, and the changes that you can make, and also the extent to which outside forces, other agencies and stuff sort of come to you and want assistance with things. And that was some of what I found very interesting.
You know, I think one of the things that worked so well for you there was that you assembled really an impressive team of attorneys and support staff. I mean, both.
Absolutely.
I mean, I just thought, you know, that was really well-run office.
Someone told me once we were viewed as the gold standard.
I believe it.
Attorney's offices. Yeah.
You know, I just to get back to one point you made. I mean, I think that what I became aware of as you were in that position was how much you just had to be an administrator. You had to run this practice,
right?
And still be in court, obviously. But I mean, a lot of it was just. I mean, I don't know that our listeners have an idea of the complexity and the number of cases that would come through the door. Just an incredible undertaking.
It is, and I think the administrative part of it was maybe what I didn't have a full handle on when I went into the office. And my view was the people that I had as lawyers in the office like to try cases. And that's what they're there for. They like to try cases, and they love criminal law, and they love prosecution. And so my job, in large part, was to keep them doing what they love to do without having them be overworked and overburdened, because that job can quickly turn into
burnout
very, yeah. Very quickly, if you're yeah. working too hard, and if you have too many cases to do. And then the other problem becomes you miss something. You forget to subpoena a witness, you forget to file a document on time, you do something like that if you have too much going on. And so my view was keep these people doing what they want to do and what they're really good at doing, give them the resources to do it well.
Exactly. And also, I think, and they would all say this, I think, you know, just take care of stuff that, you know, was in the way, you know, just
right.
clearing the deck.
Meetings, yeah.
Right. You're doing all the stuff so they didn't have to worry about
right.
it. And again, I think that's a whole nother layer of responsibility on the
right.
Commonwealth Attorney.
And then still trying to try cases, because one of the things that I found that we had to do was we had to be very interchangeable. So, you know, one day I might get up and think, okay, I've got to go to this meeting, get this done, get these jury instructions underway, do these outlines, and come home and have accomplished none of it because something happened and
something
I had to go
happened.
To court, or something happened and I had to
go to a crime scene
or whatever. So that was one of the more difficult things about it, was the juggling, but it was also part of it that I loved the most, and I think it's because it suited my ADD. It's never the same thing twice.
Yeah. You know, we talk about the fact that police departments can be very closed systems, and I'm guessing that there were some challenges with just gaining the trust of Elmore County Police Department and beginning to work collaboratively with them.
Mm-hmm. That was a bit of a challenge, and I think it took me, someone has suggested it took me about 6 months to sort of break into that and make them realize that I was there to do my job as Commonwealth's attorney. I was not doing it as a defense attorney prosecuting. But remember that I knew a lot of these people going into the job. So I knew kind of how to talk to them. I knew what they were interested in. Some of them I knew personally as friends. And so I think it was, I'm not saying it didn't take a while. It did
right.
to kind of earn the reputation that I was going to work hard and do the job. But it was a little easier, I think, by virtue of the fact that they knew me. And
okay.
I also always tried to keep a very open door and felt like if I could allow officers, defense attorneys, really anybody to come into the office and say what they thought in the manner that they talked without sort of being rigid about it or, you know, you need to respect me or anything like that. Just come in and tell me what you think. If you think I did a crappy job, I want to know that.
Right.
And I think they appreciated that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I know many of those folks as well, and know how much they respected you and appreciated your open door policy.
Mm-hmm.
So, good bunch of folks. So, what was the hardest part of that job, if you had to put your finger on it?
I think the hardest learning curve that I had, that I developed, you know, kind of an ability to be okay at, was making the really hard decisions and sticking by them, even when, you know, they were very personal for some people. You know, I made decisions to charge officers with offenses. I made decisions that sometimes would result in officers being fired. I made decisions on how to prosecute cases that, you know, didn't make victims' families happy or didn't make defendants' families happy. But those decisions are, you know, what's called for in the job. And I felt like I never let public opinion sort of get in the way of doing the best job that I could do, which, you know, may have been my downfall, but I felt like it was an important part of the job. You make the decision because it's the right decision to make, not because it's popular, not because somebody likes it or dislikes it, but because it's the right thing to do.
Right.
But that was very difficult at times.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I think happens is, you know, there may be some soundbite on the news, but people don't understand the complexity of the system and all
right.
the moving parts. And so they think that, you know, it should be cut and dried. Well, it's just not that way. It's you know, new evidence emerges.
Right.
Witnesses disappear. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. a very moving target.
Right. And one of the things I've actually discussed with you know, another attorney in town is sort of you talk about a moving target. A trial especially is kind of like a living thing. It changes and grows and shrinks as you're in the middle of it. And so you're making decisions based on a million different things that you know that maybe nobody else knows, that you've investigated, that you've discovered about decisions the judges have made, something maybe a juror said in jury selection. And you're filtering all that, and you're making decisions literally on the spur of the moment. So it's not a trial is not a well orchestrated
no.
thing that just goes beautifully and according to plan. It never does. And so you make those decisions at the you know, on the spur of the moment, and sometimes they're wrong. Sometimes they're not the best decisions, but you're held accountable for
those. Yeah, absolutely. And the buck stops there.
Right.
Yeah, I've heard it described as a chessboard, but then four more stacked on top. So you're playing five games of chess. It's just, you know, having been involved at least peripherally in many of those situations, it always just impressed me with what an incredibly complex puzzle it is
yeah.
for everybody and all these moving parts. And it's just, again, people, you know, it's not like on TV. It always looks more cut and dried.
Right.
It's much more complicated and oftentimes much more arcane, all these little tidbits of
right.
criminal process.
Right. And then, but what it comes down to is it's about people. And so I
yes.
always felt like I kind of understood and got people in certain contexts and, you know, understanding people, kind of knowing who you're dealing with, especially in a community like Charlottesville, because a lot of it, you know, who the defense attorney is, who the parties on the other side are, who the people on your side are, really come to bear and make a big difference in a
right.
trial.
And did you find over the 8 years that it sort of changed your view of mankind? I mean, you're seeing a lot of really sort of horrible stuff that's happened. I mean, was it hard to sort of keep your spirits up when you'd see these cases walk through the door?
I don't think. I'm sure there were times that it did, situationally. But overall, I think, you know, for whatever reason, I have the ability to think people are basically good. And
even if they do stupid stuff.
Even if they do stupid
evil stuff.
And that's, you know, that's one of the things that I've learned probably most as Commonwealth's attorney is everybody has a story.
Yeah, yeah.
My daughter said to me one time, you know, she was upset and I asked her what was wrong and she screamed that her life is not perfect. And I just, I said to her, you know, those perfect people, and nobody has that perfect life. And that's one of the things that I think is difficult for us just in general is we look at somebody else and we think, oh, everything comes easy for her, everything, you know, she's smart or whatever. Nothing is easy. Nobody gets
a free pass. And
right.
everybody's carrying baggage, whether we cover it beautifully or not.
Right.
You know, life is tough. It's a slog.
One of the things I would always shake my head about is you couldn't make it up. We would always kind of laugh in the office about you really can't make this stuff up. It really.
Right. It's stranger than
yeah.
fiction. We're going to take a break for a moment. If you're just joining us, my guest is Denise Lunsford, recently retired as Commonwealth Attorney for the County of Albemarle. And we're talking about her career. We're talking about the criminal justice system. And we will be back in just a moment. So please stay with us. And we are back. Before we get back to our discussion with Denise Lunsford, let's do a quick check of the weather. It is cloudy this morning, 46 degrees in Charlottesville. That's probably going to be close to the high, and we're looking for some showers, probably a 70% chance of precipitation. So my guest this morning is Denise Lunsford, who was until recently the Commonwealth Attorney for Albemarle County. And we're talking about that position and her career there and related topics. I want to mention also, before I forget, that our producer this morning is Kevin Chapman, and he's keeping everything running smoothly for us. So thanks to Kevin. So, Denise, what was the best part of the job? We talked about sort of some of the challenges. What did you really love about it?
I really loved the people in the office, the officers, the defendants that we dealt with, the victims. I like the people aspect of it, and kind of like we were just talking about, you can't make it up. It's kind of I always liked that aspect of it, just kind of observing what people did and how they reacted, as well as just kind of working with the people.
And you could really see, I think, in situations like that, the resilience of people, and sometimes just the power of the sort of human spirit to bounce back.
I mean, it's
remarkable.
I've seen some amazing things in some really bad cases. The human spirit, I think that's a good way to put it.
Now, all this time, you've got a two-career family. You've two busy career family. You've got three kids at home. I mean, how in the world, and this job, which is, 1,000 hours a week, I mean, how in the world do you keep all this moving?
I had a very good partner, understanding kids, and we had help. I mean, we couldn't
Absolutely.
Do it without help.
Yeah.
I'm not good at cleaning house or keeping it clean. I've never been good at that. So, we've always had help with that. And then at some point in the couple of years before I became Commonwealth's attorney, we got help with the kids. Mm-hmm. And, they were always very, the kids were always very understanding about my job. And if I got up on a Saturday morning and the phone rang at 11 o'clock in the morning and I had to leave, they understood I had to leave. They weren't always happy about it, weren't always gracious about it, but they understood.
Yeah, and it has to. I mean, obviously, they stepped up as well as did Richard. I mean, in terms of, I think they know a little bit about this, that they really understood what you did and appreciated the magnitude and importance of it.
They did, and they truly viewed it as a public service,
right,
and kind of knew that it was, a community that kind of needed somebody in this position who cared and was willing to get up and go out there and sort of make these decisions. I think the hardest part for the kids was when there were negative things in the media or on blogs or whatever, which, once your kids get to a certain age, there's only so much you can do to keep them from. You can make suggestions, but they're going to look. And so when people said negative things and they kind of knew the backstory, at least insofar as my input was concerned, they would get very upset and kind of standing back and trying to tell them, everybody's entitled to their opinion and, things other people don't. And, we can't get upset about that. We can't let other people control our emotions because then they win. They're in control of us. There was a lot of those talks going on.
It's a very high profile position. And so there are always going to be people wanting to take cheap shots or take shots at you. And I think that goes with the territory, doesn't it?
Yeah, it did. And I, I developed a pretty thick outer skin, but the inside was all, Richard and I referred to it as the big old pile of goo on the inside.
Right.
And not everything rolled off, but I did develop the ability to kind of step aside after a while and just, figure, as we were just talking about, everybody has a different take on life because of what's happened to them. And, somebody who said something really nasty may have had a really bad day or may just be, a negative person or whatever, but I couldn't allow it to control what I thought or how I reacted or how I behaved. But for so long, I can I allow myself to get mad, but then I have to kind of move on.
We touched on this earlier, but if you could just share with us a little bit about sort of what was the nature of the interaction with the police and sort of your take on that part of the job
Just in general, as it relates to cases? Or
well, you know, as relates to just having, you know, when you get brought in and how much consultation you have with them. And I mean, it has to be an active, I'm guessing it has to be an active ongoing process.
It is. And it's, so it was a larger case. It's really, I always looked at it as a team effort. So if we had someone who, if we had a shooting or a stabbing or something that was going to be at least a malicious wounding, maybe a murder, depending on whether the person lived or died or things of that nature. I always wanted to get a call on it. I always wanted to know. And it, my sort of guiding.
Right at the time? Like
yeah.
They're on the crime scene.
Right.
You want to hear
yeah.
about it. Okay.
And the officers, some of the detectives sort of developed a notion over the years of, you know, there were some cases that I was really going to need to know about because this person might die, and other cases that obviously that wasn't going to happen, so maybe I didn't need to know about that one. But I wanted to know at the time because I'm sort of a visual person, and I always felt like it helped me to go out and look at the crime scene instead of just looking at pictures or being told about it. So I wanted to be called. If I would get the call, I would, you know, make the decision whether to go out or not. Usually I did. And then it's sort of very much a team effort. I was trying to stay out of it. You don't want to become a witness or put yourself in a position of putting something in a crime scene, dropping something that, you know, would cause a problem. So I tried to hang back and ask questions and answer questions, too, because even if you don't go out, sometimes there are issues about, do we put this in the search warrant? Do you think we're going to need that? You know, questions about someone who maybe want to make a statement or whatever. So you're on the phone, even if you're not out there most of the time. And it, like I said, it was really kind of a team effort with those kind of cases. And even oftentimes then when we get called in also on policy decisions, body worn cameras was a new thing.
Oh, well, I was going to ask you about that and just get your take on body
and
cameras.
So, you know, we want to collaborate on what the policy is going to be. What does the Commonwealth attorney expect with regard to how this is going to be used? What do you need with respect to the chain of custody of the recording? You need to know how it works. You need to know when the administration wants them to activate or turn on the camera, when they want them to turn it off, how it's downloaded. You kind of have to know how all of that works, and then work with the police department on developing a policy about what's best practices with regard to the storage and the disposal and how long you keep it and how you keep it. And we actually did that a couple of summers ago. One of the Commonwealth attorneys from the city of Charlottesville and I worked with UVA to develop their policy because they were actually the first to implement in the area.
Really?
And we
huh.
wanted, one of the goals that we had was that largely their policies, at least with respect to how the information gets to the Commonwealth's attorney's office and how we get access to it, we wanted the policies of UVA, the city of Charlottesville, and Alamo County to be the same.
Yeah, it makes sense.
The big difference is in most policies between departments are when they activate the camera, when they turn it on or off, and how long they store the information, and that both of those things, to some extent, have to do with cost. Because
okay.
when you activate the camera, it's creating a recording, and when it creates the recording, you can't just get rid of that recording. You have to store it somewhere, and that's mm-hmm. what creates the cost. So we worked to create a policy that was going to be consistent, at least in those some respects, of all the departments. Or it might be, you know, we've got one of the big sort of time drains on the office as a whole was disposing of property, either evidence or things that have been found, the case is over, it's not going to be appealed.
Okay.
You know, what do we do with all this stuff? And that sort of depends on what kind of case it is. In a murder case, you may want to keep it forever, or rape. In a, you know, a property crime, you don't. Some people want their property back if it's in good condition. So, you know, all those, there's a million different things. You're dealing with the police department every day.
Yeah. And all the complexity there. And is there now a uniform policy on body cameras for the three departments?
When I left, there was a policy that was uniform, like I said, in some respects, that was going to be implemented in the city. I don't think they've implemented yet. I think they have the equipment. And in the county, that, like I said, the differences were how long they were going to retain the videos and when they were going to activate the cameras. But by and large, that policy was in place and consistent in the other
states. And certainly that cameras alone are not a quick fix for anything. I mean, I think it would also put an added burden on the on law enforcement to even manage all that and keep up with it.
It's, yeah, human. You have to have someone to manage just that sort of program. And
remember to cut it on at a traffic stop or something.
And that's in addition to just the other human that has to be back at the police department to kind of manage all this stuff. But yeah, the officers, there's a training, a certain amount of training that's needed. How do you operate it? How do you turn it on? How do you download it? What can you do with it once you get it downloaded? But then there's the remembering to turn it on. And, one of the debates these days is, do you tell a citizen you're having an encounter with that you're recording it, or do you not? And do you record every encounter? Because there might be a citizen who comes to you with information who doesn't want to be recorded, and they're not going to give you that information. Mm-hmm. What about when you go into someone's house? All those kind of issues that drill down to some extent beyond the Commonwealth Attorney's what we'll be thinking about. But by the same token, if there's not a video and body cameras are in place, and we get to court on a case, we're going to need to explain why there's not a video.
Okay.
And so, that everything to some extent is a consideration.
And there are constitutional issues, it seems to me, or tell me if they're not, with regard to privacy. If you come into my home with a camera on, I mean, there's going to be some pushback, it seems to me, from the defense bar.
The defense bar. Perhaps in the defense bar, I think, is mostly concerned about if it's there, I want to see it.
Okay.
I need to know it. But there are some privacy considerations that others are raising, for example, and being in someone's home is a good point. But if you're in someone's home because you got called there on a domestic, and we all know from what happened, I think, in Maryland a couple of weeks ago, domestics are can really go bad
very quickly.
And they one of the most dangerous calls that an officer goes out on. And so when you get called to someone's house on a domestic, I think you kind of want that there to show exactly what happened, even though you're in someone else's house.
Yes.
And they did call you. So,
right.
Think less of a concern when you get called in than if you're just going in for another reason.
Yeah, these are complicated issues. So I'm curious about whether you felt being a woman in this position in a very traditional community, I'm guessing probably the first female prosecutor in either Albemarle or Charlottesville ever when you won election. Is that fair to say?
Yeah.
Did you bump up against any sort of sexism or gender bias?
From the people I work with, I think not, and that might be a product of, again, personality, and I just don't look for it. I tend to think, with regard to the officers and the attorneys and the courts, I do a good job. I get treated as another lawyer, and it doesn't matter what I'm wearing or whether I'm a woman or a man or anything of that nature. So, and then again, as I said, I had worked here for a long time. So,
right. You were well known to the community.
I was known, and my personality was known, and officers and others kind of knew that they didn't have to, watch their language or anything like that around me. And so it was, I've never perceived that from anyone I've worked with, either on the police department or, attorneys. I do think there's still sort of this, for some reason, in the media and maybe others, there is some sexism, and maybe, I like to think it's unconscious, that they're not thinking about when you someone comments on a blog about what you're wearing or what your legs look like or what your hair looks like or something of that nature. You just don't see as much of that as it relates to men.
Rarely see it as it relates to men.
And that's disappointing. And it's, I'm raising a daughter. She's 14. And and frankly, my sons, you know, it's difficult when you have that to say, you know, okay, they commented on what I was wearing and the length of my skirt, and we all know that that's not important. And, you know, guys, you're not supposed to do that either. And you don't call women certain names, and you don't, you know, and to my daughter, you know, it's okay what you wear. Mm-hmm. You know, it should be appropriate for the occasion, but if you decide you want to wear jeans to work one day and you don't have any clients, that should be fine. That should be your call. And how short your skirt is, as long as the judge doesn't call you on it, should be okay. And I think to some extent I was lucky in that regard because I was kind of, as you said, the first female Commonwealth attorney, but I was also... There still aren't a lot of people in the bar who dress the way I do. And you know, I've explained why I dress the way I do. It's how I feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's one of those things that we shouldn't have to talk about, but we obviously do. But I was lucky because I just sort of assumed that everybody would accept it. And by and large, within my profession, within the bar, with the judges, they kind of did.
Right.
And so it should be a non-issue.
And I do think there's still
not
a double standard.
Not that you don't get good-natured ribbing, but I've, right. you know, teased officers about their pants before, too.
Sure.
So it's something that happens. But, it, you know, I think there is sort of sexism there. I think there's, you know, people have told me that some people make the comments that they do because they're intimidated by me, and I understand that I can have the sort of glare that it's just kind of weird to explain. I never felt there was any sexism from the people that I worked with on either side of the bar, either
right.
as a defense attorney or a prosecutor. But I never looked for any special treatment either.
Right. No, I hear that. But I do think that, you know, you made the point, and it's often the case, you see it in politics as well, that we hear a whole paragraph
oh, yeah.
about what her hairstyle was or her clothing. How many guys, you know, do you ever right. say, oh, you know, Congressman Jones has a terrible comb over, you know, blah, blah,
mm-hmm.
you know. I mean, it's just never an issue. And
right.
I think it's still in the culture somewhere.
Right.
And it probably is unconscious, but it doesn't mean you don't bump. And I think you did bump up against it in some way.
Yeah.
Certainly, I'd see it in the media, and I just want to say, wait a minute, what does that have to do with anything?
Right. And I actually asked one time, back when I was a defense attorney, I had one of the prosecutors tell me that, and I was wearing, for me, a very conservative outfit, that my skirt was too short, it was actually down to my knees, and that my earrings were distracting. And so the next day when one of the jurors called me to tell me that I had done a good job, I asked him, was my skirt too short? Were anything about me that was distracting? And he sort of acted like why was I asking him this stupid question? And that was the point at which I just decided it was some people and it wasn't everybody.
Yeah. If you're just joining us this morning on the Mind and Heart Show, my guest this morning is Denise Lunsford, who recently retired as Commonwealth Attorney for Albemarle County. And we're talking about her career and other matters in the law. We're just going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Denise with some more questions. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with you in just a minute. And we are back with the Mind and Heart Show. A couple of programming notes. We will not be on the air next week. I'll be away and back the following week. So 2 weeks from today, please join us again. My guest on that Saturday will be Becky Waybright, who is the executive director of SARA, which is the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. And we're going to be talking about some of their preventative programs and the services that they offer. If you're just joining us this morning, my guest this morning is Denise Lunsford, who was the Commonwealth Attorney for Albemarle County through December. She was in a tough election fight, which she lost, and is now just trying to get rested from all those years of 80-hour weeks. Following our show this morning is Straight Talk with Andra Haake, so stay tuned for that. She's on from 10 to 11. And then from 11 to 12 is Pat Peason, and he's talking about all manners of money. So stay tuned for Pat as well. So stepping back from the whole situation, Denise, what would you say is the current status of the criminal justice system in Virginia? Do you think it's running fairly smoothly? Does it need need some revisions? I know that's a huge question, but just your general sense of case law and statutory law in Virginia, criminal law.
It is a huge question, and you know, there are a lot of things that are happening today that kind of bring it to the forefront. Some of the things that are that have happened here in Charlottesville and Albemarle with respect to particular cases. I think overall, while there might be some particular things that need to be fixed or corrected or tweaked or however how you want to put it, I think overall the system works well. We have a unique bar here in Charlottesville in that we have some really great defense attorneys and some really great prosecutors, and we get along well together, and there's not a lot of, you don't hear claims of hiding the ball or things of that nature. I've been one of those people over the years who believe in the jury system, and I believe actually the jury makes the right choice most of the time. I may not agree with it, but I can certainly understand why juries do what they do, and I've had arguments about that both as a defense attorney and as a prosecutor with other defense attorneys and prosecutors. I tend to think juries do the right thing, and I think they work very, very hard when they're in a case. I don't think they make decisions just, you know, I don't see a lot of, in my experience, a lot of what we call jury nullification.
Right.
But I think overall, and I may be accused of kind of rose-colored glasses, but I think overall the system works well. I think we hear about the things that go wrong, but that's kind of the case with anything.
Right.
We love, you know, a controversy. We love that something awful has happened. I mean, you know, when you drive by a crash, you love to rubberneck and look at it.
You can't not look at it. Right.
And I think that's a lot of what we of what is perceived to be wrong with the system is those sort of bad examples that, that happen because our system is comprised of people.
People
do the work.
Yeah.
So.
But I wanted to echo your point there, which is, you know, having worked in Albemarle, Charlottesville for many years, but also in surrounding counties in the federal system when I was working, we're very fortunate here. I think we have really smart prosecutors, really capable defense attorneys, public defenders, judges that really get it.
Right.
I mean, I'd go to these outer counties and present forensic psychology evidence, and some of these courts wouldn't have a clue what I was talking about. And the judges here would ask for an evaluation. They'd want to know.
I remember going down to Fluvanna, and this was many, many years ago with a different judge that's down there now, and can't remember exactly what the point was, but I was arguing a point that had been recognized by the Supreme Court in a case, and it was very similar to my case, and the judge said, but we don't want to believe things like that, do we, Ms. Lunsford? And I was thinking, well, yeah, we
it's
we
the law.
Look. It's right here in this case.
Right. Yeah, yeah, it's a different world out there in the hinterlands sometimes. Did you have sort of statutes that you felt needed to be changed or new statutes enacted that things where there were just glaring difficulties that you kept bumping into?
There were a couple of things that I have worked on over the course of the past few years as Commonwealth's attorney, and there are always, as I said, things that can be changed and maybe made better or shored up. Mental health courts is something that I'm really passionate about. I just think that there are so many people in our jails who come through the criminal justice system, maybe who aren't in jail, but who just need, it's sort of like drug court is the way I view it.
Right.
It's not a matter of not holding, I don't know what's wrong with my voice this morning. It's not a matter of not holding someone accountable. It's a matter of holding them accountable and also making sure that they receive the treatment and the services that they need to overcome this issue in their life that sometimes is controlling what's happening to them.
Right.
Just like an addiction does in some respects, which is also in the mental health.
Yes.
So I really think we as a state, and if not as a state, at least as a community, need to consider that and consider a different approach in cases where mental health is obviously an issue, but that doesn't rise to the level of not guilty by reason of insanity for the
right.
legal
no,
definition
a huge,
of that.
Yeah, and you know, you used to spend a lot of time at the local jail, and the jail, lots of mentally ill, actively mentally ill people there, mm-hmm. and the jail staff is just not equipped to, they do a phenomenal job with their resources, but they just,
right.
it's not a hospital, it's a jail.
Right.
And people just languish there and get often worse.
Right.
That would be such an improvement if we could get something implemented even statewide.
Yeah, I agree. They do a great job at the jail, but, you know, they have limited resources, too. They have a limited function in what they're supposed to be doing. And treating people for mental health issues over the long term is just not one of their functions.
No.
It's not what they're designed to do. The other thing that I worked on that I think kind of needs some attention is laws as it pertain to sexting amongst kids.
Oh, gosh.
It's and actually, I was on this group called the Virginia Criminal Justice Conference that is judges, defense attorneys, and prosecutors that come together and basically come up with legislation that everybody agrees on, or at least everybody in the room, all three disciplines, and present it. And one of the things that we tried to come up with was sort of a solution to the sexting problem among juveniles, and just to kind of give you a sense of how that kind of works on just sort of a basic frontline issue, if you have a young woman who has taken a picture of herself nude that might rise to the level of pornography and sends it to her boyfriend, should the boyfriend be prosecuted for possession of child pornography, assuming this girl is 14, 15, something of that nature? Well, that's, you know, kind of a, we've had some parents say, yes, obviously, that boyfriend needs to be prosecuted. Well, let's not forget the fact that the young woman actually created the child pornography.
And is she charged with production of child pornography? I mean, I've had cases like that.
Is she charged with distribution? Because the way the law is written, she's actually in a worse shape than the young man is for simply possessing it. And then what happens when that young man, when the two of them break up, sends it on to all of his friends, or sends it to even one of his friends, who sends it on to other people? And I think there was no really good solution that we were sitting around that table able to come up with, because there's always the, you know, they break up and the boyfriend sends it to everybody in school because he's really upset, or there's the boyfriend who shows it to someone else who gets a copy of it, and then that person sends it to everybody in school, not because they're really upset, but because they think it's funny.
Yes.
Or something of that nature. And so, but you don't want to, at the same time, make these kids felons for, I mean, kids have phones, kids have bedroom mirrors. One of the officers that I've talked to has argued that, you know, maybe they shouldn't have both, maybe they should only have one. But this is the kind of stuff that happens, and we don't want to make kids felons, but we do need to hold kids responsible if they're taking pictures secretly, if they're sending them on for malicious reasons, and there are all sorts of nuances that are in that issue. Different states have different ways of tackling it, and
yeah.
One of the things that we've done in Virginia is kind of just decide we can't come to a consensus. We're going to leave it to the local prosecutor to have common sense and hope that that works. But what happens is it's not consistent then across the state. So,
And the other thing that I've had concerns about over the years is it's also increased the number of kids that are being put on a sex offender registry, which to me is way over the top. You know, we know that young people have impaired judgment. That's why we have a different juvenile justice system.
Right.
But to put these kids, you know, I've had cases where the boyfriend's 18 and the girlfriend's 16 or 15, and they get caught in a sexual situation, and he's charged with some sex offense and may end up on the registry. And,
right.
And there he is for the rest of his life.
Right. And there's no taking the facts or the nuances of a particular case into account. And, you know, as a prosecutor, I always say, well, the law is what the law is. But
yeah.
We all know that as a prosecutor, you can manipulate what the person is charged with or what they ultimately get convicted of. But with the sex offender registry, there's no taking into account what those facts are.
It's, right.
You know, if you get convicted of a certain offense, that's it.
Yeah. Yeah. When that system was first put in place, I think there were 4 predicate offenses that would get you on the registry. I think when I retired, there were something like 24.
And I can never remember what they all
exactly.
are.
Exactly. And every year the legislature, will add new offenses because it plays well with constituents in an election. And, you know, it's like shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, nobody's ever going to oppose you for cracking down on sex offenders. But, you know, we've made this pool of people so big mm-hmm. that it's created its own bureaucracy just trying to keep up with them.
Well, and I think that, you know, makes me think of one of the things I always think about when people are concerned about the criminal justice system or putting people on sex offender registry or, you know, whatever the issue is, and that is it's all fine and good for everybody else, but then when you come after my son to put him on the sex offender registry, now we got a problem.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of people don't think about is, you know, it could be your son. It could be your daughter.
Right. Yeah. We've only got a few minutes, and I wanted to ask you about a case that got resolved before you came into office and has recently been in the media, and this is the case of Mr. Davis, who appears there was a false confession in that case. And I guess that's another thing I've often had concerns about is that if you put somebody under sufficient duress, sooner or later you may be able to get a confession out of them. And just wanted to get your either specific thoughts on the Davis case, if you feel you can speak to that, or if not, general thoughts about, you know, how do we make sure that confessions are truthful and valid?
You know, I don't want to speak specifically to Robert's case, primarily because it's been so long since I was involved in it. There was activity that was happening on that matter after I came into office.
Oh, there was still.
I sort of divorced myself from that. I let whenever anything had to be done on it, I asked my deputy to handle it. And then at one point we had a special prosecutor appointed to
right.
look at what had happened in the case because I had been one of his defense attorneys. And,
right.
and I have this tendency to kind of remember the broad facts, but
right.
I can't drill down to the nitty-gritty years after a case. So I don't want to speak to
okay.
that generally.
Fair
but
enough.
In particular, or in general, false confessions, things like eyewitness testimony, you know, as a prosecutor, you don't hang your hat on one thing.
Right.
It's not like we have a confession or we have a witness. Or, you know, you're always looking for other evidence. Whether it's forensic evidence or whether it's, you know, a confession with an eyewitness, with, you know, some other circumstances or things of that nature. So, you know, you're kind of always alert to the, you know, the possibility that, you know, a witness may be lying, a witness may be mistaken, something may have happened in a statement or a confession that makes it unreliable. But you're not basing your case on one thing. And
right.
that's what I think, you know, a lot of people lose sight on as prosecutors. You know a lot more information than is ever presented at trial. It's not just one thing. It's not, well, he confessed, so we're going ahead. It's usually a compilation of a bunch of other circumstances and facts and information.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, it's, again, these tough decisions, you know, that get reduced to sound bites, but
right.
you know, you're having to deal with the complexity of it and all the different pieces of evidence and so forth. So yeah, those are things I think just as a system though, we need to pay careful attention to
right.
the research that's going on. There's a lot of research going on false confessions, a lot of research going on eyewitness testimony. And I just think that needs to continue to inform our legal system. So we're almost out of time this morning, and I wanted, obviously we didn't get through all my questions, but I wanted to ask you a couple closing questions. One is, if your daughter came to you and said, I'm thinking about going into become a criminal lawyer, what advice would you give a young woman who's starting out or considering going to law school and taking on this challenging career?
Well, if it were my daughter, I'd tell her to go for it because she'll be really very good at it. She can argue with anybody.
Like mother, like daughter.
You know, I'm one of those people that thinks that a law degree is a good thing to have, whether you're going to practice law or not, because it teaches you a way of looking at both sides of the issue, of kind of understanding both sides of an issue, and not getting kind of mired down in your own view. And so it teaches you a way of thinking that I think translates well into a lot of different avenues. I would encourage any of my kids to mm-hmm. do that. You know, I've gotten into a discussion several years ago about, but it costs too much money to do if you're not going to be practicing law. And it does. But frankly, you're not going to get rich practicing law in Charlottesville and Albemarle
right.
County. So,
right.
You know, it's not just, to me, it's not just about money. It's about what you like and what you think you want to get up every day and do. And if you can't get up every day, and sometimes you don't know this until you get into it, but if you can't get up every day and think, you know, I'm going to work, you know, on a bad day, or I get to go to work on a good day. If you get up every morning and think, I can't stand going into this place and I really don't want to do it, then you need to find another line of work.
Right.
Whether, you know, you're a lawyer or whatever, because you're just not doing your best.
Yeah. Yeah. And you've been in a sort of a period of recovery from the difficult job.
Yeah.
I guess the question is, are you considering the next step for you professionally, or are you still, is the jury still out on that?
I am. I wanted to take some time off to kind of think about it and get my wits about me and not just jump into something. And I'm fortunate to not have to go back to work immediately. I have to go back to work at some point for my sanity and for my family's safety, so that I don't get too involved in what's going on with them. I wanted to take some time off and kind of decide what I want to do when I grow up, as I tell people. And I haven't really made any final decisions yet. I wonder whether I could go back to defense practice.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I mean, it seems to me that would be tough or challenging, just because now you've been on both sides of the table. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a different world, I guess, seeing things from the prosecutor's perspective than as a defense attorney.
Yeah, it is. And I think there's a lot of that would help a great deal with defense work. I'm just I wonder, you know, whether I can do it, and I'm sure that I can. It'll just be how much it bothers me to do so.
Yeah, when you've got a case that you knew as a prosecutor,
right,
you might have very different thoughts about
right.
it.
And this is a small community. You deal with the same people over and over and over
you
again.
Do.
It's
yeah,
kind of
same
this is kind of nice that way, but it's also, you know, bothersome at times.
Yeah, but you do think you'll stick with the law in some capacity?
Yeah,
You're not going to start, you know, a different, wholly different career selling insurance or something?
Not selling insurance, no. My family thinks, or my kids think I need to go to the knitting shop and get a job selling yarn.
Well, there you go. That'll keep you busy anyway.
Yeah.
So my guest this morning, if you're just have joined us recently, is Denise Lunsford, who is was the Commonwealth Attorney for Albemarle County for 8 years. She lost a tough election in November and is now deciding what she's going to do when she grows up. So I want to thank you very much, Denise, for coming in this morning and giving up a Saturday morning and sharing your wisdom with us. And I appreciate it very much.
Thanks a lot, Jeff. It was really good to be here.
Great. So stay tuned. At the top of the hour here in a minute, Andra Hakes will be on with her show, Straight Talk. I think her guest this morning is the director of the International Rescue Committee for Charlottesville, and they're going to be talking about resettlement of refugees, so that should be an interesting conversation. Next week, we will not be on the air, or we may run a prior show, and then we'll be back in 2 weeks with Becky Waybright from the Sexual Assault Resource Agency. So take care, and we'll be back with you soon.
You've been listening to the Mind and Heart Show with your host, Dr. Jeffrey Frazier. Be sure and tune in again next Saturday morning at 9 o'clock for another edition of the Mind and Heart Show, only on WPVC-LP, Charlottesville.